Sit back, relax, and enjoy some spoken word entertainment here with us now at CITR 101.9 FM.
Let's see here.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody.
After the Rising in the summer of 1916, George Bernard Shaw, arguably the world's most famous living playwright at the time, decided to draft a monologue for Roger Casement, who was about to go on trial in London for the capital crime of high treason. He was seeking to import arms from Germany to Ireland in preparation for a rising. Even though Shaw did not think that Casement was right to forge an alliance with Germany, he still believed that Casement, as an Irishman, owed no allegiance to the British Empire. He felt he had the right to do what he sincerely believed was best for his own country, Ireland. And Shaw expected Casement to literally perform to save his life. But Shaw was also not keen to make him a martyr. He was personally sceptical about the value of martyrdom. And in his play, The Devil's Disciple, the character of Burgoyne does not really want to hang the rebel Dick Dudgeon and says, "It is making too much of the fellow to execute him. Martyrdom, sir, is what people like. It is the only way in which a man can become famous without ability." Shaw wanted to save Casement from martyrdom. He felt it was essential that Casement should conduct his own defence and tactically speak to the jury before it had condemned him. However, Shaw's monologue was not performed and Casement's lawyers persuaded him to adopt a conventional defence, contesting the facts and making the speech only after he had been condemned. Casement, while awaiting his execution, sadly regretted that he had not performed Shaw's speech. And here it is, Shaw's unheard monologue, written specifically in defence of Roger Casement.
Gentlemen of the jury, I plead not guilty to the charge of high treason, but I ask you not to take this as a denial of the essential facts relied on by the Crown. What I deny, rather, is that any guilt attaches to those facts. I have spared you the tedium of calling witnesses to prove facts which I do not dispute and of which I am not ashamed. Indeed, rather than seeking to repudiate the Crown's case, I embrace it. It is quite true that I made up my mind that my country ought to achieve her independence of English rule by force of arms. I hope that, in a very humble way, I might do for my country what Garibaldi has been honoured in England for doing for his country, Italy. You may smile at my vanity now that I have failed, but you know that nations are not freed by personal modesty any more than by personal vanity. And a nation which cannot produce a Garibaldi has to be content with Roger Casements, and the Casements must do their best. I concluded that it was no more possible for Ireland to free herself without foreign alliances than it had been possible for Italy to free herself without the help of France. I sought to obtain the assistance of the German Empire in this enterprise. I have no apology whatever to make for that. It was my plain duty to my country. I did not want German troops in Ireland. What I wanted from Germany was money, munitions, and Irish soldiers, and this was all I accepted. The German authorities collected their Irish prisoners and invited me to persuade them to take part in my enterprise. I did my best. I need hardly say I did not ask any English soldier to fight against his own country. I know how to respect other people's nationality because I know how to respect my own. An attempt has been made to prejudice me on the ground that I was formerly in the pay of the British Empire and that I was knighted for my services to it. I am glad of that now, because the fact that I served England well enough to have my services publicly acknowledged and especially rewarded shows that I have no quarrel with England except the political quarrel, which England respects and applauds in Italy, Poland, Belgium, and in short, in every country except those conquered and denationalized by England herself. Almost all the disasters and difficulties that have made the relations of Ireland with England so mischievous to both countries have arisen from the failure of England to understand that Ireland is not a province of England, but a nation, and to negotiate with her on that assumption. If you persist in treating me as an Englishman, you bind yourself thereby to hang me as a traitor before the eyes of the world. Now, as a simple matter of fact, I am neither an Englishman nor a traitor. I am an Irishman, captured in a fair attempt to achieve the independence of my country. And you can no more deprive me of the honours of that position or destroy the effects of my effort than the abominable cruelties inflicted 600 years ago on William Wallace in this city when he met a precisely similar indictment with a precisely similar reply have prevented that brave and honourable Scot from becoming the national hero of his country. It may seem to some of you gentlemen of the jury that I ought not to be hanged for being a traitor. I ought to be hanged for being a fool. I will not plead that if men are to be hanged for errors of judgment in politics, we should have such a mortality in England and Ireland that hardly one of us will be left to hang the other. But I may ask you, if you nevertheless lean to that opinion in my case, whether my attempt, desperate as it seems, has been, after all, so disastrous a failure. I am not trying to shirk the British scaffold. It has been the altar on which the Irish saints have been canonized for centuries. But I confess, I shrink a little from the pillory in which the public opinion of the world places men who, with the best of intentions, can do nothing but mischief to the cause they embrace. But I do not think I shall occupy that pillory. Will you understand me when I say that those days of splendid fighting against desperate odds in the streets of Dublin have given Ireland back her self-respect? We were beaten. Indeed, never had a dog's chance of victory. But you were also beaten in a no less rash and desperate enterprise in Gallipoli. Are you ashamed of it? Did your hearts burn any less? Did your faith in the valour of your race flag and falter because you were at last driven into the sea by the Turks? Well, what you feel about the fight in Gallipoli, Irishmen feel all over the world about the fight in Dublin. Even if it had no further consequences, even if it had not sent your Prime Minister, who had shelved the Home Rule Act as if it had been a negligible parish bylaw, scuttling to Dublin, I should still glory in the feat of arms. And now, gentlemen, you may hang me if you like. I will not even add and be damned to you, because I feel no more ill will to you than I did in the days when you were glad enough to claim my public work as the work of an English consul. You have no immediate vengeance to fear for it. It cannot be said that you dare not kill me. I hope that my countrymen, whatever happens, will not waste their energy and degrade their souls with idle dreams of vengeance, even if the fortune of war should make it possible for them to give effect to them. My neck is at your mercy, if it amuses you to break it. My honour and reputation are beyond your reach. The Lord Chief Justice will presently tell you, I could anticipate the inevitable summing up for you if I doubted his ability to express it far more weightily than I. He will tell you, as he must, that legally, I am a traitor. But history will not, on that account, absolve you from the most sacred duty of a jury, the duty of standing on the side of right, truth, and justice between all honest laymen and that part of the law which was made against their own consent to destroy them. The question for you is not whether I have broken this law or that, nor whether what I have done comes under this or that legal classification. The question for you is whether I am guilty or not guilty. And if you allow any judicial direction to distract you from that issue, you will betray not only me, your political enemy, but every man alive who has nothing but a jury between him and the worst that the dead letter of unjust laws can do to him. I hope that I have spoken here today as you would desire an Englishman speak in a German court if your country shared the fate of mine. I ask for no mercy, no pardon, no pity. I sincerely and humbly beg your pardon if at any moment during this trial my inextinguishable pride in being an Irishman and my exultation in the bravery and devotion of my countrymen has betrayed me into an exhibition of vanity or arrogance. Of any trace of malice, I know I am entirely free, for I feel none and shall feel none, whatever the upshot may be. Gentlemen, I have done my duty. Now, it is your turn.
You're a member of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend? Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 with discounts on Commercial Drive at
Audio Pile, High Life Records, Mintage, People's Co-op Bookstore, Stormcrow Tavern, The Rio Theater, JQ Clothing Limited, and Bone Rattle Music Limited.
Merciful God, in what a frightful condition was the country at that time. I speak now of the north of Ireland. It was there, indeed, the seat of Orange ascendancy and irresponsible power. To find a justice of the peace, not an Orange man, would have been an impossibility. William Carleton, Autobiography, 1869.
The poor Irishman lives in the simple house of his childhood with the well-known neighbours and faces. They warmly welcome him. He is barefoot again. Walt Whitman, The Sleepers, Leaves of Grass, 1855.
From a corner, from above the paraffin tins, I hoisted a black and white sign of mouldering wood. John Montague, prop. Now, small head of the household, I hauled out the shutters each evening to board up the shop and post office with panels larger than myself. Singing in the summer twilight when the job was done, singing to my weary aunts, singing to the wild lynches across the way, singing to the clerks on the next block, singing to the cows in their stalls, singing to the pigs in their crow, singing to the hens settling onto their roosts, singing to old Tim clopping in his stable. October winds lament around the castle of Dromore, but peace is in her lofty halls, my dearest treasure stored. A solitary minstrel of family dreams, with my private menagerie of ghosts and animals, my unbroken boy soprano breaking the membrane of the gloaming, that sign of ownership at my feet, John Montague, prop. Dread spirits of the Blackwater, Clan Owen's wild banshee. My grandfather comes riding by. I see his glorious long beard as he sits in his sidecar or jaunts in his pony and trap. He hails me.
But John, that was always my name, look at that wooden sign. Yet you may carry it on. And please, keep singing. I heard you summon Clan Owen's wild banshee. She has always followed our family. Take time to thrive, my ray of hope, in the gardens of Dromore. Take heed, young eaglet, till your wings are feathered, fit to soar.
Take time to thrive, my ray of hope, in the gardens of Dromore. Take heed, young eaglet, till your wings are feathered, fit to soar. He cracks his reins and disappears. A bare-legged boy, I crouch on my creepy stool on the edge of the reddening hearth and stare up the open chimney to where, through turf smoke, I spy clouds like galleons coursing by, or scramble up the stairs to where a windowless room shelters the remnants of his library. The candle flame trembles as I read, rocking in his cushioned chair as if John Montague, J.P., were still there, pondering his many volumes instead of me, a Brooklyn urchin troubling his air. In my grandfather's library there were many volumes, Bibles massive as flagstones, heavy print my eye could trawl along, the thunder of the Old Testament. I climbed the mount with Moses, stood in the presence of the Lord, or listened as he spake from a cloud. For lo, I had suffered the long exodus from Brooklyn and New York, where they worshipped the golden calf, which now staggers, newly born, rasped clean by its mother's tongue on the cobblestones of our farmyard. I chanted the Proverbs and Psalms, and later bathed in the Song of Songs. Thy love is headier than wine, honey and milk lie under thy tongue, thy lips drip as the honeycomb. To what dark-eyed maiden might I yet sing such a song? Lily of the valley, Rose of Sharon. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John blessed the bed I lay upon. My grandfather's bed in my grandfather's room, but I loved the revelations of yet another John. He of Patmos, a woman clothed with the sun, a two-horned lamb who spoke like a dragon. Locusts with breastplates of iron, the heads of the horses as heads of lions. The apocalypse, God's horror comic, like the scary film with Boris Karloff, I had seen on my last day in Brooklyn and can remember as the rats scamper above the damp blotched wallpaper in the shadowy rafters over my head. The beams of our house are cedar and our rafters of fir. John Whale's House of the Dead, seen by a small boy, now transplanted. Christmas stars stud the sky as in my grandfather's bed I lie.
What are you doing in my bedroom? Plundering my library? Perusing my will? Where the devil did you come from?
John begat James, who begat John. Why did you sire so many children, you old goat with luxuriant beard and sideburns? I am second generation, fruit of your loins, who has come from afar to dwell with your two maiden daughters, your eldest Bridget, your youngest Winifred, in that rural empire you founded.
Like Ruth, amid the alien corn.
Except I was born in Depression, Brooklyn, a raw, raucous place you have never seen, with clanging trolleys and lurid neon.
So you were born in America, where they had that terrible civil war. Mar of the sword at Fredericksburg, where over 1,000 Irish died, sporting their sprigs of green. Look at those photographs of slaughtered soldiers, arranged by Matthew Brady, next to Whitman, in my library.
With Butler's Lives of the Saints and Vasari's Lives of the Artists, at least you were Catholic in your tastes.
And in my thoughts. Cardinals Wiseman and Manning conducting their lofty debates around the Immaculate Conception. Ponderous and Victorian to you, perhaps. Though Catholic, I serve the Queen as postmaster and lay magistrate. A bleak land after the famine. No need to read the Riot Act. White gloves often on the bench. A small cog in the imperial machine. The greatest empire ever seen.
And lo, led your people out of Egypt. Downhill, that is, from Alta Muscan and Alta Clochan to this broad road that sweeps from Derry to Belfast. Years later, in troubled dreams, I hear ghostly carriages rumble past. My grandfather's clock was too tall for the shelf, so he spent 50 years in the bed going tick-cock, tick-cock, until he stopped short, never to go again in Garvahy graveyard. Many years without slumbering, tick-cock, tick-cock, many children engendering. I saw his grave dug open to admit another daughter, sired in that same iron bed I now occupy, listening to the rodents rustling overhead. His thigh bone seemed enormous, large as the jawbone of an ass. But I was only an altar boy, clothed in mystic surplice and soutane over New World knickerbockers, to serve her funeral mass before the fresh clods struck the coffin, brass handles, polished wood. Remember, man, that thou art dust, and into dust thou shalt return.
That ditty should have stuck in your throat. Why must you strike such a vulgar note? Without me, you would not even exist, so a little courtesy would not go amiss.
Listen, you old fecker, you may be my grandfather, but the round world has rolled on since then.
And completely lost its manners.
You had cardinals, Manning, Wiseman, Newman, ruminating over the immaculate contraption. My heroes were Tiger Flowers and Slapsy Maxie Rosenblum, and then the Brown Bomber and Billy Conn. Livelier than your solemn red-hatted procession. Did you never play stoop ball? Put nickels under trolley or tram?
Brash as an American. You don't sound like my grandson, or even an Ulster man. Do you know Newman's definition of a gentleman? A gentleman is one who never inflicts pain. Study that for a while. Then speak to me again. Besides, large families were common then.
But what would your poor wife have to say? But who was my grandmother? Silence, or almost. Her name, I learnt, was Quinn, pronounced locally Queen. The robust one of several sisters, afflicted with consumption, wasting away slowly, slowly, in the house across from our own. The Lynches and I played in its ruins, wrestling in our dungarees amid swollen grain sacks as bats looped through broken windows, unaware of where we were, walls blighted by illness, now shrunken to a storehouse for horses, cattle, hay. And I have only one photograph of a tightly corseted woman. She unlaced them ritually for my grandfather's embrace in this same iron bed, night after patriarchal night, until she died in childbirth. A grandparent myself, I say a word for her now, a silent, solemn figure lost in the shadows of a doomed place, before she crosses the road through the portals of our house into male energy and merriment. In my grandmother's time, one woman was queen of the known world, another virgin queen of the unknown. So, shall I name her our lost queen, our lady of shadows, our lady of shall not? A patient figure at her spinning wheel, without whom I would not have been.
Out of the darkness, I dare to speak. I am not the silent queen of Garvahi and Altaclocken. I am not a plaster saint. I am not a figurine. If my John can speak across a century's silence, why should I stay mute? I was a flesh and blood woman, the strongest of my house. So do not distill me into dream. But how the men were spoilt, grouped in the parlour, scarcely bothering to lift their plates to help us when we served, daunting like sucking calves as we ladled out their portions. Then back to the talk and drink again.
And abashed, I recall a rare flash of anger from Aunt Bridget. All the men together playing cards and drinking whiskey while we hungry children cried. Whitman saw Ireland, an ancient sorrowful mother, once a queen, now lean and tattered.
Will you have a tither of wet, man? Or I'll push you before me bosom. There were mouths agape, bottoms to clean, cows to milk and churns to turn. A hearth crook heavy with pots and pans, farls of soda and wheaten bread. I was more able than most men, though I left all the gabble to them. And you seem to forget. I loved my John. He was a fine figure of a man. Handsome as Victoria's German one. Did you know that every night in Windsor, Albert's clothes were laid out on the bed and she slept with his picture over her head? She presided over her unfurling world, India, Africa, the Crimea and Khartoum. As I presided over mine, Garvahi Altaclocken, pressing the treadles of my sewing machine, So wasn't I happy to have my John and that lively bunch of children? And wasn't he the great scholar, the only a class of hedge schoolmaster?
That scringe of chalk on slate.
He was so pleased when Cousin Joseph became a cardinal with his book on Prophet John. And who are you anyway, you whippersnapper, sharing our family secrets with the world? So I say again, have a tither of wit, man.
I looked up to my dad when I was younger. I used to watch him work, which might be a bit morbid seeing as he's an undertaker. But it was never about the bodies or the death or anything. It was always about the families. That's what I saw. My dad comforting people in their time of need, ever compassionate. And I thought he was great. The way people looked up to him, relied on him. I suppose I was young and that's what young kids do. Think their dad is the richest and fastest and can beat up everybody else's dad, no problem. I don't know when it started to change, but it did. Maybe I just grew up a little. The paint started peeling off the office walls, and the spots of rust on the hearse grew into patches. And I noticed that despite all the comfort my dad gave the people who came in our door, he could never really help them. Actually, it was more than that. Those are proper things to think about when you're a teenager. The thing with the florist, that summed up my relationship with my dad.
Hey, Derek. It's Niall. Niall Graves. From the funeral home, yeah. Yeah, Donald's son. Oh, nothing much. Times are tight, you know yourself. How's the flower business? Can't complain? Yeah, I'd say. Although with those prices, I'm amazed no one else has. I thought I told you already we have someone else who'll do the same as you for a third of the price. And then last night, I see this very sizable bill from you for flowers we never ordered. My dad ordered them. No, I don't think so. He never told me. Of course I'm privy to that information. It's called Graves and Son for a reason. Yeah, well, we'll see. And don't call me kid.
Oh. Watch where you're going.
Sorry.
I'd never seen her before. She was gorgeous, in an angry way. I decided to pull out my best line.
What are you doing here?
Ugh. Even if that had come out right, it would have been terrible.
Excuse me?
I mean, a girl like you in a place like this.
I suppose I'm trying to find somewhere to stay.
Oh, I can help you with that. There's a bed and breakfast down the road, Cassidy's. They'll sort you out. Tell them Niall sent you.
Niall?
Me. I'm Niall. I'm kind of a businessman.
Oh, I see. Thanks.
Do you need me to walk you down?
It's just down here, is it? No, I'm all right. Thanks, though, Niall.
Oh, okay. You're welcome anyway.
I'm kind of a businessman? Well, By the time I got back to the office, I had forgotten about Derek and the flowers. My mind was on other things. But as I struggled with the Banjax lock on the front door that Dad had promised to get fixed 3 months ago, things turned back to normal. More bills.
Dad! Dad, did you see these?
ESB, gas. Hadn't we paid these?
Dad!
Yes. Yes, Mary, I understand. No, don't worry. There must have been some mistake with the docket. No, no. It's not going to cost 3,000, of course not. No, no. It would be around the 2,000 mark, if that's all right. Yes. Listen, Mary, we'll call it 1,800.
Dad, no.
Okay. Okay. Okay, Mary, very, very sorry for your loss again. Of course, Mary. Thank you. Take care now. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Dad.
Don't give me that look.
1,800? That barely covers our costs.
At least it covers them. Where were you going with 3,000 anyway? They were living on Davy's pension.
He was an engineer. His pension is probably more than we make.
They've got debts just like the rest of us, Niall.
Ah, yes. The villa in Spain and that petrol-guzzling monster truck, of course. They're a real charity case.
We're covering costs. It's fine.
I just don't understand you sometimes, Dad. Is this a business or what?
There's nothing to understand. We just don't take advantage of people. We're not starving and you can take the car anytime you want.
The hearse, Dad. Stop calling it a car. It's a hearse.
At least it's a Mercedes.
Don't even start.
I remember you used to boast to all your friends that your dad drove a Merc.
When I was 9. And do you really think that banger's good for business? That people like they're dead being carried around in that heap?
I wish we could afford something nicer. But the business isn't there, Niall. The recession and all that.
We're an undertaker's, Dad. The business is always there. People don't stop dying just because the economy has taken a turn.
And we can't start gouging people just because you want some flash wheels. You know, this thing, Niall, it's special. It's more than a service. It's a calling. It's about compassion. Caring for people in their hour of need. That's what this job is, Niall. I just want you to understand this, because when I'm gone, you know, it'll be you handling things.
I called Derek earlier.
Oh, you saw the invoice then?
I told you we could get the flowers cheaper from someone else. I told Derek that we wouldn't use them anymore, and then you go back to him.
Derek's been doing our flowers for 20 years.
Yeah, and he's been ripping you off for 20 years too. I don't think you understand. You didn't even tell me. I look like an idiot today. And you know what? You look like an idiot too. Everyone knows how much of a pushover you are. They take advantage of you and then they laugh at you behind your back. You're an embarrassment and you're making me an embarrassment as well. Dad, you say you want me to take over. That this will be all mine someday. A take over what? There'll be nothing left for me, Dad. Nothing.
Oh, Niall.
Forget it, Dad. I'm going for a walk.
Take the car if you want.
I think that was the first time I ever slammed the door on him. Might have been a bit harsh, maybe. He wasn't a bad guy, really. I grew up well, got fed. We never had anything too fancy. I thought that was just how it was. How it was always going to be. It was fine. But I think he still thought I was a kid. I think he still assumed I automatically looked up to him. He didn't realise that I had dreams of my own. I think he was a bit of an idiot sometimes. Then again, so was I. I headed up the road a good bit. Didn't really know where I was going for a while. But eventually got to Bentley's dealership. I used to hang around there a lot. Just peering in the windows of the new 3 Series he had in. In this drab and dank town, those cars just seemed to shine. I never really talked to Peter Bentley, but I'd seen him around. Suits as nice as his motors. That day, he was standing at a red convertible talking to a girl. That girl. From earlier. I thought he must have been doing better than I had with her. Charming a woman must be like breathing to him. But something must have happened. She turned away from Bentley and stormed towards me.
Hey.
Hey. Niall, right? The businessman.
Yeah, that's me.
You don't know that creep, do you?
Who, Bentley? No.
Niall, how are you?
Brilliant.
Not to worry, Niall. Sometimes the fish just aren't biting. It is Niall, isn't it?
Yeah, Niall. Mr. Bentley.
He'd never spoken to me before. I was kind of taken aback. He was tall. Would have been intimidating if it wasn't for that smile. He was instantly charming. He extended his arm.
Please, call me Peter.
Who is she? I didn't even get her name.
Oh, just another happy customer.
She didn't seem so happy.
Well, these cars aren't for everybody now. She was looking for something that I couldn't really help her with. Say, how's your dad?
My dad never said a word in his life about Peter Bentley. Then again, he didn't tell me about the florist either.
You two know each other?
Oh, yeah. We go way back. Well, I'm not surprised he hasn't mentioned me. He's probably busy counting all that money of his. You can make a mint in the funeral business. It's recession-proof. Debt never sleeps, they tell me.
If only. That's what I tried to tell him.
Oh, really? Well, I'm sure things will pick up. They always do. And that goes for your problem with the women as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Peter.
Nice to meet you, Niall. I must get back to work now.
Bentley turned on his shiny Italian heel and I stood there wondering what had just happened. I just had an entirely unembarrassing conversation with one of the richest guys in the town and we were on the same wavelength completely. Was that how things are meant to be among adults? Was that how respect felt? And then he turned back around and offered me something my dad would never even consider.
Actually, Niall, how would you like to take one of these for a spin? Do you like it?
Like it? It's amazing.
Oh, there's some kick in it, all right.
It's a rocket. What is it, 2 litre?
Yeah, diesel. Very economical. Low tax as well. For what you're getting, it's a very popular model.
Oh, I'd say. I wish I could afford it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Takes a while to get out of the sales mode. You know yourself.
Yeah, definitely.
I didn't know. I wasn't selling coffins with turbochargers or leather interiors.
You know, Niall, I don't just offer test drives to anyone. We're both businessmen, you know? You can't just give things away without getting something back in return.
I'm not sure what you mean, Peter.
I have a business proposition for you.
About the funeral directors? You might have to ask my dad about things like that. He hasn't been very receptive to my ideas.
Yeah, well, that's exactly why I'm coming to you instead. Your father was never much of a big thinker. You, however, seem to have much more of a business mind than he does.
Well, I don't know.
Of course you do. I was thinking of some sort of sponsorship deal. Well, you like this car, right?
Yeah, of course.
Well, then, how about you keep it on a medium-term lease?
In return for what?
Of course. Nothing comes free. You're a smart lad.
I wasn't entirely sure what Bentley was angling for, but I held my suspicions. He had been nice to me so far, given me some respect. I owed him that.
Well, this might seem a bit unorthodox, and this is exactly why I came to you with this, instead of your dad. I thought you might be a bit more open-minded.
Peter, I'm not sure what we're talking about.
It's my dog.
Your dog?
Yes, he died yesterday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I loved him dearly, and I just wanted something to remember him by. I can't bear to throw him in a hole outside. He was always more of a house dog. I was wondering, and as I said, this is quite an unusual request. I was wondering if I could have him cremated.
Cremated?
Yes.
I don't know. Health and safety would throw a fit. I'm not sure my dad would allow it.
But you're not your dad now, are you?
No. I'm not.
He got me there, didn't he? My dad would never go for something like this. A small bit of work for a big reward. It always had to be the other way around with him.
So, have a deal?
Yeah, sure. But it'll have to be tonight, after my dad's gone.
Oh, of course. So, how will we work this out?
I'll leave the door open and everything ready to go. It's just a matter of pressing the button. Have you ever been to a cremation?
Oh, yeah. I've seen it done. Fantastic. Niall, you don't know how much this means to me. Oh, listen, you just take a left here and drop me off back round at the dealership. You might as well take the car now.
Now?
Yeah. Think of it as a show of faith. Hey, it's nice to know I'm not the only sensible person in this backward old place, huh? You come on inside and we'll put some ink on these forms.
Oh, man, did I feel good. Wheeling and dealing with the best of them. And the car, pushing it to the limit. Flying around the back roads of the county, it was amazing. It was the best I'd felt in weeks. Complete and utter freedom. I took a right down the green road, past the small copse beside the graveyard. I suppose it was time to get back to the office. Face the music. But as I rolled past the graveyard gate, I saw a small figure walking between the gravestones, shoulders hunched. My dad. I wasn't ready to talk to him. Not yet. Not in this car. Luckily, he wasn't really paying attention. He stopped at a grave, touched it lightly. My mum's buried there. I feel like I'm 12 again. 12 and scared.
Niall. Son.
Dad? Did the doctor say anything about Mum?
Yes. They did.
She's not okay, is she?
No, she's not.
I pulled into the car park, made sure to close the door carefully. I hunkered down behind the small graveyard wall. I kept telling myself I should just stand up, walk over, apologize. We've had rows before, it wouldn't matter. But I didn't. I just peeked over the lip of the wall. He was gone from the grave now anyway, walking back towards the church. I slipped in the gate and sidled up against the cover of the larger headstones, following him. You know that feeling when your head tells you to do one thing and your legs want you to do another? My head said forget about him. My legs told me to go after him. So I followed.
Dad, more sympathy cards came.
Oh, did they? That's nice. Let's see. Ah, from the Flanagans. Nice people. And Marie Lennon. She knew your mother back in school. And Niall? The rest of these are from you.
Yeah. Well, everyone else was sending them and saying they miss her and, well, I miss her even more than anyone, so I thought I had to write more cards.
Niall.
Are you going to see her now?
Yes. I've to prepare the body for the wake.
Can I see her?
I don't think that's a good idea.
Hey, Mum. Her grave was immaculate. The headstone was picked out by my dad. He had the stonemason carve a tiny little heart at the bottom. He said they were never ones for grand displays of affection, just plenty of little ones. I saw Dad was just here. We're not getting on the best lately. I'm sorry. I know you'd hate that. But I thought I should tell you. He probably said it as well. Did he tell you that he's just letting that florist rip us off? No? I bet he didn't. You always taught me to stick up for myself. That no one can live without respect. Well, I did. But why do I feel so bad? I don't come around here enough. I'm sorry.
No, that wasn't so bad, was it?
No, There were a lot of people crying, though.
Yeah. Your mum was very loved.
You didn't cry.
I know.
Didn't you love her?
Of course I did. I just had to be professional.
You don't have to be professional anymore. If you want, I can do it for a while.
Thanks, son. I appreciate that. You're a stronger man than me. I've made some very big mistakes during my life, Niall. I've done some things that you or your mother wouldn't be proud of. But the thing about mistakes is that you make sure you only make them once.
I said my goodbyes to my mum and started after my dad. He was out of sight now, in the small wing of the chapel. I didn't know what I was going to say to him. I stopped when I heard him speak.
I keep saying it till I'm dead. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
He was lighting a candle. The room was dark and the flame lit up his face and glinted off the trail of wet down his cheek. He ran his hand through his hair.
I'm sorry, Andrew. I'm sorry, Rose.
What was he talking about? I ducked behind the corner and watched him pass. He didn't see me. I didn't know who Andrew or Rose were. He never mentioned those names to me before. I sat in the graveyard for a little while longer before driving back into town. I parked the car and walked towards the office. The door was closed, so that meant I'd beaten him home.
Hey, businessman!
The girl from earlier. Third time's a charm, Niall. Hey, again. You know this is the third time I've seen you today and I still don't know your name. Nailed it.
It's Amanda. Amanda Byrne.
Well, it's nice to meet you, Amanda. Again.
Nice to meet you too, Niall, again. You work here?
Yeah, I'm the son in Graves and Son. I like to think we're partners at this stage.
Graves? Your dad's Donal Graves?
Yeah. That's him. He's not here at the moment, but if you want to arrange a service or something, I can take care of it for you.
I've had too many of those already.
Okay. What then?
Look, I realised that I might have been a bit rude with you earlier, and I wanted to maybe offer to take you for a drink later. If you're free, that is. I need someone to tell me about the area.
And just as it was going so well, my dad arrived to throw his own unique brand of awkwardness into the mix. I think I'd pretty much forgiven him about this morning, if there was actually anything to forgive. But something niggled at me, like there was still so much I didn't know about him.
Niall, I didn't expect to see you back. And who's this? Customer?
Yeah, this is Amanda. We just met.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Didn't you want to speak to...
Here's my number. Give me a text and let me know a time and a place for later.
Number.
Yep, I'm as surprised as you are.
She looks familiar. Is she from around here?
I don't think so. Listen, Dad, about earlier.
Don't mention it. I'm sorry too. I went down to Derek after you left and just told him that there'd been a mix-up in communication and that we wouldn't be needing his services anymore.
Well, how'd he take it?
Oh, he cursed me out of it, of course, but... hard to be scared of a man holding a handful of petunias.
Yeah, well, the new lady is much nicer anyway.
And cheaper.
And cheaper.
Here, give us a hand heating this thing up, will you?
Remember the time we roasted marshmallows on this?
Oh, yeah. And the sticks themselves caught on fire and nearly burned our eyebrows off.
And we had to get the giant-sized marshmallows because the normal ones would melt before we even put them on. And even still, they tasted horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And then your mother came down to us with some hot chocolate and some perfectly toasted ones that she'd done on the grill.
I still think ours were more authentic.
Authentic. That's the right word, all right.
As he laughed, there was a glint in his eye that I recognised. There was a smile and a common understanding between us after so long without. It seemed like we actually knew each other again. I decided to tell him about the car.
Listen, Dad. Okay, now, don't be mad, but I've something to show you. Here, look out the window.
What's that?
It's mine, Dad. Well, ours. For the business.
That's brand new. How could you afford it?
Well, it's only on lease as a sponsorship arrangement. We can use it to visit clients and not have to drive the hearse everywhere. We won't be the laughing stock of the town anymore.
Imagine us driving up to a house with a bill in a car like that. They'll think we're ripping them off.
No, they won't. They'll think we're legitimate business people who take pride in our work. Plus, we still have the hearse if you're that opposed to it.
You're right. We still have the hearse, and that's what we'll be using. Where'd you get it anyway?
From Peter Bentley.
Bentley? What are you doing dealing with that gangster?
I didn't know you knew him.
I know him well enough to know that he's not to be trusted. I'm sure this was his idea, yeah? And what did he want in return?
Nothing. It's a sponsorship arrangement between two local businessmen. Advertising for him, professionalism for us.
Advertising? I don't think Bentley would give anything away for something as little as advertising. What did he say to you?
He said you two were old friends. I don't know what everybody has against him. Amanda and now you. He treated me like an equal. Imagine that.
Amanda knows him.
They were talking, yeah.
What's her name, Amanda? Her surname?
Byrne. Why?
She looked so familiar.
Dad, what are you talking about?
You're giving back that car. Right now.
No, I'm not. Not until you tell me what's going on.
What's going on is bigger than you can handle, son. And if you're not going to give the car back, then I'll drive it right down to Bentley's office myself.
Fine. Take it. But just so you know, I saw you at the graveyard today. I saw you in the church. Who's Andrew, Dad? Because right now there's a lot of things I'm feeling very in the dark about.
There are some things, son, that I just can't tell you about.
That's not the way this works anymore. There shouldn't be anything you keep from me. I thought we'd fix this. But you just keep making the same mistakes as always.
Oh.
And then he left. Took the car away. Just for a shining moment there, I thought we understood each other. But we never really did. I tried to compose myself a little and gave Amanda a text. Drinks, O'Hara's, as soon as humanly possible. I left the back door open for Bentley, as per our agreement. I knew how to treat people right.
Sorry, you here long?
No, not that long. The crowd looks pretty colourful.
Yeah, this town. Lots of characters, all right. Pint of Guinness there, John. And you, Amanda.
Give me a Jameson, no ice.
You know, to be honest, I kind of expected that. How many have you had?
Not enough.
I know that feeling. Actually, John, make mine a whiskey too.
I didn't even like whiskey. It dulled the senses a bit too much. So I suppose it has its uses.
Rough day?
You wouldn't believe.
Try me.
Ah, you don't want to hear my problems.
Come on, spill.
The last thing I wanted to do was to dump all my issues onto the one girl who might actually like me. But I don't know. There was just something about her that made me want to talk to her. Tell her everything. Somehow I had faith that she'd just take me as I was. But I at least tried to be manly about it.
Ah, it's just my dad, you know. Some people, you think you know them and then...
Yeah, I get that. Definitely.
She gave me a look. Honestly, I don't know what it actually meant, but I don't think I'll ever forget it. Inscrutable. Determined, vulnerable, vicious, and beautiful all at the same time. Turned out her mother died very recently. I told her I remembered how that felt, and she told me that she couldn't even remember what it felt like. That it was all jumbled up, all the emotions, all the worries and fear. Eventually it just turns into a long, constant drone. It doesn't fade away, but you get used to it. Talking with her made me forget about things for a while. I think she even coaxed a smile out of me.
So what happened with your dad then?
Basically, he didn't like my new car.
Really? Why not?
Well, it was maybe more he didn't like who gave me the car.
Bentley?
Yeah. He took the keys and brought it back and told me to stay away from him. He wouldn't tell me why, of course, because apparently I'm still a kid and can't be trusted with the truth.
Sometimes the truth sucks.
Better than secrets, though.
Yeah. How well do you know Bentley, anyway?
Not very. I think today is the first time I've ever had a real conversation with him. He said he and my dad used to be friends. But I've never heard my dad mention him. Until he was telling me to stay away from him. I'm not entirely sure what to think anymore.
They were friends, if that helps you decide.
What?
Bentley and your dad, they were friends. And my dad too.
How do you know?
My mum told me. She knew them all.
Why are you only telling me this now?
Because I'm looking for him, my dad. And I didn't want to go spreading it around. Before I was born, he ran off with another woman. Peter Bentley came to my mum when she was pregnant and told her. She left here after that.
And now she's gone and you're looking for him. That's rough.
Yeah, I know. A little girl just looking for her daddy. What a cliche, right?
Just a bit.
Well, his name's Andrew. But if your dad didn't mention Bentley, then I doubt he would have told you about him.
My heart stopped for a moment. I know that name.
What do you know?
My dad said it today. At the church, he lit a candle for him.
Bentley said he never heard the name in his life.
I think there's something they're not telling us. Listen, we'll go back to the office and have a look for anything that points to your dad. A picture or phone number, something like that.
What about your dad?
What about him? I never got to finish that thought. And I'm glad. I answered the phone and time froze. I saw the last day fall away before me and everything I thought was important, every awful feeling I carried on my back just dissolved and pooled around my ankles. I hung up the phone and looked at Amanda.
Who is that? Niall? What's wrong?
My dad. He's been in an accident.
The Leo Ramirez Show at CITR, Mondays from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. El show de Leo Ramirez en CITR, lunes de 5 a 6 de la tarde.
And that's all the time that we're going to have tonight for Scald's Hall on CITR 101.9 FM. Coming up in just a moment or so, we'll have Canada Post Rock with John. So from all of us here, please have a safe and happy weekend.